Straps that hold the guardian ring, spinning loose, a wearing thin, a wearing thin, the biting through, the shifting power leans to you, and the cord is on a wheel.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for Wednesday morning call and talk radio here on KBOO Community Radio, where the time is 36 minutes before 8 o'clock, and the number to call to join in the conversation this morning is 503-231-8187. Well, I'm very pleased to have as a guest this morning in the studio Eileen Brady. I'm waking up here. Eileen Brady, who is the former vice president of the Food and Farms Program at EcoTrust and is also a co-owner of New Seasons Market. And we're going to be talking today, kind of a continuation of the discussion I was having last week with Eileen's husband, Brian, who is the CEO of New Seasons, and Peter Schoonmaker, who is with Illahi. And this kind of comes out of this Illahi symposium that we were both at last Friday that was looking at oil water in Oregon and had some very fascinating conversations about sustainability and what that really means. And so Eileen has been working on a number of projects about creating sustainable food systems here in Oregon and in California. And so we're going to be talking about that. But she also has a little basket with some strawberries in it. So, good morning, Eileen.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
And are these Oregon strawberries?
Those are from my garden this morning.
Fantastic.
We're here for inspiration. I have four little strawberries. They're barely coming on. The season is just about to start. I think the U-pick season opens this weekend.
Yeah, I picked two strawberries out of my garden the other day, and the slugs got all the best ones, as usual.
Right, of course. Right.
But we were talking about strawberries, actually, last Friday at one of the workshops, which was about sustainable food and agriculture and sort of the intersection between having sustainable food systems in this region and dealing with the fact that we're going to, believe it or not, we might be running out of water. So let's talk about how strawberries fit into this picture of what is a sustainable food system here in Oregon and why, at least in my mind, is strawberries kind of the essential icon of what could be or is not sustainable in Oregon's food system.
I think you and I share this love of strawberries as an icon of the food system. Some people would say it's the tomato. It's the heirloom tomato because you can't get tomatoes as fresh or tasty as homegrown local tomatoes. But since we're in strawberry season and it is my favorite fruit and I celebrate my birthday every year with strawberry shortcake and strawberry daiquiris, not cake, which in my birthday is just in a couple of weeks, let's talk strawberries. Strawberries are one of those products that don't transport well if they have a lot of flavor and taste in them. They tend to be more fragile. So when we talk about having local food systems and really wanting to build our local food systems, it's the fresh, local, tasty, flavorful strawberries that come to mind for me. You know, products like, as a matter of fact, in Oregon, I don't know if you've been to the farmer's market but the number of melons, off strawberries for a second, but the number of melons that exist that are grown within 10 or 15 miles from here is unbelievable. But they're so fragile, their skins are so fragile, you can't transport them, which make them truly a local fruit. They're grown locally here. They're really only eaten here, which is true for Oregon strawberries as well. In terms of fresh strawberries, they are mostly eaten locally because they can't be transported. They're like our special secret.
And in fact, I mean, I've actually had conversations with one of the produce people at New Seasons that there's differing perspectives depending on who you talk to. But the guy that I guess agrees with me, we were talking about, well, the California strawberries are still all that's in the market this week. And I would say something, and he said, well, they're pretty good for California strawberries, and I'd grimace, and he said, well, it would be really nice if California would raise strawberries for taste as opposed to looks. But in fact, California strawberries, even the organic ones, seem to me that the first priority is shipping ability, which seems to be a contradiction, kind of an oxymoron, having a shippable strawberry.
Well, it's actually, in California, there are several delightful local versions that we don't see up here. But in order to transport them up to Oregon, they're mostly growing the old Chandler variety, which is not a bad variety, but it has a lot of water in it. It doesn't have a lot of sugar in it. The oils aren't very balanced in it. And so it transports well, and it always looks the same every time you get it. And so
it always tastes the same, too, I think.
It always tastes the same. As a matter of fact, I don't think it's really the same food as an Oregon yummy, you know, Rainier or... even a totem strawberry in Oregon.
Well, I was learning a lot about strawberries this weekend. I went to the Tigard Farmers Market, and I was talking with a young woman who was selling strawberries at the Unger Farms stand. And she was saying that, I mean, she was like maybe 16, 17, but she knew a lot. She was, first of all, talking about the Hood variety, which is the one that I think is being farmed at least around here right now. And I'm assuming that our strawberries are all named after mountains. Is that
kind of... It sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yeah. But she was saying that there's something about the soil and the climate here in the Willamette Valley, which, in her opinion, in her vast experience of 16 years, the finest strawberries in the world. So maybe it's not just you and me who think this.
Right. I think that we can't disagree. It is the best. It is one of our best-kept secrets. We really probably should have a whole tourism event around
strawberries,
drawing people to Oregon during the fresh strawberries. It's really only 3 weeks. I mean, it's such a precious time. And then it's, you know, to really begin to think. I love that the 16-year-old is out there talking about the berries, because I think the real one of the indicators of a sustainable food system is if your children, our children, can talk about what's in season when. Asparagus comes on early in the spring. It's a great thing to teach your children. Strawberries come on in June. Then we've got raspberries and blueberries, and we're going to, you know, peaches are going to hit in August.
Don't forget the cherries.
Yeah. You know, I'm not a big cherry fan, so I probably skipped over that on purpose.
Yeah, that's coming up really soon.
Right. Yeah.
And that's the other fruit that I think a lot of people think that in the Northwest, I don't think it's specifically the Willamette Valley, but the Northwest is a really prime place for cherries. And I've been a cherry fan all my life, even growing up back east, and I realized I never really tasted a cherry till I was in the Okanagan Valley in British Columbia in 1970. And it was like the third week in June or fourth week in June, and it was like, my God, this is what a cherry tastes like. And it was a real eye-opener for somebody who lived in Northeast cities all my life and not been that close to farm produce.
Right, and I grew up in Chicago, just north of Chicago in Evanston, Illinois. And when I came out to the Northwest in about 1980, and somebody said, let's go strawberry picking, I actually had no idea how strawberries grew. I had no idea if they grew on a tree or... on a bush or what have you. I couldn't believe how backbreaking it was to actually pick them. And to really come in contact then with tasting it, I realized, oh, my God, I have never had a strawberry. This is a real strawberry. This is the richness of this place. I've had the same experience with chanterelle mushrooms from this region as well, to go out and look and find chanterelle mushrooms in the middle of a forest and then take them home and eat them. There's nothing like it. It really creates a sense of place.
Well, one last side about our personal experiences with fruit, but I lived in Sandy in the 70s, and I lived surrounded by raspberry and strawberry fields, and a lot of the farmers let us pick, and because it was pretty high up, the season, actually, you're picking strawberries in July, and so if you want strawberries, you go out to Furwood Road in Sandy in, like, mid-July, and they're still there.
That is a great tip.
Yeah, and, I mean, if they're still the field, I don't know, this was the 1970s, but I was out there a few years ago, and it's still basically an agricultural road, and I remember going out there and doing these U-pick strawberries in July, and it was a difference also of living around them, like they were surrounding me, and so I had this more connection to it. But I also discovered I much preferred to U-pick raspberries than U-pick strawberries.
Yeah, exactly. You can stand up.
So I'll let somebody else pick my strawberries. So the other sad thing about, or the sad thing about strawberries, though, we were actually talking about this on the show a couple of years ago, that there's been a big shift in farming practices here in the Willamette Valley in the last few years, because it's also not really a profitable venture anymore for Oregon farmers to grow strawberries. And so a lot of Willamette Valley farmers have shifted to grass seed. And I can't think of anything quite as much of an extreme in the edible world as going from strawberries to grass seed. So let's talk a little bit about that shift. And by the way, I'm talking with Eileen Brady, who is the former vice president of Food and Farms Program at EcoTrust, and she's been working on a bunch of different kind of sustainable food system projects around the West. And if you want to join in the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 17 minutes before 8 o'clock here on Locust Focus. So what does it mean that Oregon farmers are not so much growing that you, in fact, I heard a figure last Friday about the difference in the number of strawberry farmers that used to be and how many there are now.
Well, just to throw out a few statistics, not to bore anybody with statistics, but Oregon, probably in the 1950s, had around 18,000 acres in strawberries. And this year, we're under 2,500. So it shows you we've got a decline in numbers of acres. And the reverse is true in California and Florida, that there is a lot more acres. There's probably over 30,000 acres of strawberries in California this year. And people are eating more strawberries year-round. So from a, depends how you look at it. If you're a nutritionist and you see that people are eating more fruits and vegetables, this is a good thing. If you're someone who believes in eating seasonally, then people are eating more foods out of season, and this is a bad thing. But in terms of this, let's go back to strawberries for a second. So if we've got from 18,000 acres to 2,500 acres in Oregon, that means we're growing less strawberries. And as a matter of fact, we're actually exporting strawberry starts, you'll love this, to Mexico. And then, of course, we import those strawberries back in, which is always interesting. So the farmers are suffering, and we are they are switching over to grass seed. They're switching over to horticultural type of products where they can make more money. Strawberry is a labor-intensive product.
The labor of love.
The labor of love. And, boy, is it worth it. But some of the interesting things are that and per capita, they have all these, there's all these statistics out there of how much food you eat every year. So, for instance, you eat 17.5 pounds of tomatoes every year on average, the average American. And in terms of strawberries, it's about 6 pounds of strawberries a year. So if you'd said, could Oregon, are we at a risk of not being able to feed ourselves strawberries, you just have to do the math, and you pretty quickly realize that there are plenty of acres of strawberries to feed Oregonians. In fact, it probably takes about, in Oregon, given the yields that you get on strawberries, which is about 10,000 pounds per acre, it would take about 2,000 acres to feed every Oregonian 6 pounds of strawberries a year.
How about those of us who eat 15
However,
pounds of strawberries?
For you, we need a whole different state. So I don't think we're at risk of losing fresh local berries. As a matter of fact, most of the strawberries in Oregon are grown for processing. They're grown for making jams or ice cream.
I think Häagen-Dazs ice cream uses Oregon strawberries for their strawberry ice cream. I was reading something about that recently.
Exactly. Häagen-Dazs, I think Ben and Jerry's. There's a huge, I think it's about, don't quote me on this, but it's close to a third of the strawberry processing berries go into ice cream, into higher-end ice cream, which is an interesting example of what you have to do in this market if you're a smart farmer right now. Farmers obviously are completely challenged by the global economy and the prices they can get and the cost it takes to grow any of these products, including strawberries. And the challenge that they have is really to create value that's other than a price point type of value. So can they create a product that's more flavorful or more grown more environmentally correctly, or the labor practices are better, or and. So strawberry growers are in the same situation where they have to create a product that has a value other than price, because it's going to cost more to grow it. And some of the best farmers are doing that. They're aware of the market. What they used to say, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, just to give you a little history, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture back in the 1950s said, get big or get out to the farmers. And that was kind of essentially, people call that the beginning of the agribusiness industry in the U.S. So get big or get out, that was kind of the battle cry. And by the time the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture in the 1970s rolls around, Earl Butz, he's very famous for having basically implemented that strategy, get big or get out.
And did that a lot through subsidies, or the way that the farm subsidies...
And managed the farm subsidies to the point that that would work. We are now at a point where farms are in such crisis that there's a need for a different battle cry. And the one that is out there that is starting to emerge is decommodify or die. And I've actually heard this in Oregon first, even though I've spent most of my food research in California lately. The Hatfields, who are famous for Oregon country beef or country natural beef, as it's now called, walk around the country and talk about this. If you want to save your farm or your ranch, you need to decommodify or die, which means your product can't be a commodity product anymore. You're not going to make it on the world market. You are going to fail. You can't compete on price only. You have to compete on quality.
Let's actually talk a little bit about what this commodity means. I was listening to some lectures I recorded of Michael Pollan lately, and who was here a few weeks ago, and he talked about how corn is the ultimate commodity because basically it can be dried and stored, and then it's like money. So let's talk about food as a commodity, because people who are familiar at all with the stock exchange and things like that might have a vague idea. But what's the difference between food being a commodity and food being something being food?
Well, food being food, I like that. What happened? When did food not become food? What's the history of that? Food as a commodity really basically means that food is only considered for its price. And it's you mostly see that, and more commonly see that, on products that are supported by subsidies or the Farm Bill, and which tend to be a lot of big grains, corn, wheat, also things like sugar, but throw in rice, that those are the products that are heavily subsidized, which, by the way, are the Midwestern states get the bulk of those subsidies. And I don't know it's hard to know if people know this, but I always was always surprised by it when I think about it and I heard about it originally, was that fruits and vegetables are not subsidized by the Farm Bill, which is interesting. So we've now incentivized the system to produce lots and lots of grains and sugars. And these have become kind of the traditional commodities. But any product that's just sought after on price alone is a commodity.
And so then there's this big difference between having, because commodity has to be something basically that can be stored and shipped. And the idea of storable, shippable vegetables and fruits seems to, again, contradict what our concept of what it is we want to put in our bodies.
Yeah, the sustainable food system of the future is really not about storing products. It's about figuring out how to build strong regional food systems across the country, around the world, that have highly perishable, fresh products that we're putting into our bodies on a regular basis, not stored products, easily transportable products, products that meet all the economies of scale criteria, because those products, as it turns out, are probably not the best products for our bodies. So the sustainable food system of the future really is a very healthy food system, and we're going to be eating a lot more perishable foods, a lot more interesting foods. 18 different types of heirloom tomatoes simply will not be enough. And Michael Pollan speaks a lot about corn. He is fascinated with corn, and he has followed the corn system. And what he has gracefully laid out in his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, which is just a tremendous book, is the path that we've taken to on corn. So we subsidized corn heavily. That means we overproduced corn. And without going into all the financial details, it encourages farmers to overproduce corn. And then the food system needs to find a place for that corn.
It also
to
drives
go.
Down the value of corn.
Drives the weight on the value of corn, right.
That gets more subsidized.
Right. It's this incredible spiral. And as a result of that, in the, I want to say mid to late 70s, some Japanese laboratory scientists created this thing called corn syrup, and high fructose corn syrup, which really isn't a food if you actually look at what it is. And Michael Pollan has traced corn in all of its forms, particularly this corn syrup form, into our food system, and it is pervasive. Pick up almost any packaged product, and you're going to see some type of corn product in there, and that's not by accident. That's by incentive. That's our system incented that. And then it turns out that the obesity epidemic, if you look at the trend lines on the obesity epidemic, they are very similar to the trend lines on eating more and more high fructose corn syrup.
In fact, somebody was telling me the other day that high fructose corn syrup actually makes you crave for more sweetness. and it encourages your body. I think Michael Pollan writes about this too, but another friend was actually giving me more of the chemistry behind it, that it makes your body, it tricks your body into thinking it can eat more sweetness and more calories than your body would think if it were eating cane sugar instead. And so it's kind of an insidious creation, because it really is. I mean, it's not just that people are drinking more big gulps because everything's supersized, but this, the chemical, the main ingredients in those big gulps is saying more, 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 and your body's kind of lost its thermostat to know when to shut off the sugar meter.
Right. I don't know much about the chemistry of corn syrup, but that makes sense to me, particularly if you look at the tenets of anybody, at the food technologists. There's a lot of, in these big processing houses, General Mills or a series of them, they have these food technologists who really are chemists who are our food is being designed for us. And so those food technologists are designing foods that we want to eat more of. And they have a problem, because ultimately the food market is inelastic, meaning that everyone can only eat so much food. And it's a problem for these big food manufacturing companies, because how do you get someone to eat more? And they actually do these studies on the big gulp, these big drinks, oversized sodas, evaluating how much of this you can actually ingest, put into your system. And then they build products around that to try and push the limits. I have this fantasy that somebody's going to come out of the manufacturing world and write a book called Confessions of a Food Technologist and tell us the truth.
Well, I know that right now that movie Thank You for Smoking is playing around the circuit, so maybe that'll be the next one, is Thank You for Eating Corn Fructose.
That's a great movie, by the way. Recommended.
So I am talking with Eileen Brady, and she is the former vice president for Food and Farms Program at EcoTrust, and also a co-owner of New Seasons Market. And we're talking today about sustainable food systems. It's about 5 minutes before 8 o'clock here on KBOO Community Radio. And if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-818. I can't imagine how that came across on the air. We have a little secret here that nobody in the listener audience is supposed to know.
Maple bar secret.
That's right. But I also want to let you know we're testing out a 7-second delay system here. And so we're just learning how to, in case somebody calls up, as people have, not in the too distant past, called up and said things that we could have our license yanked for. So we're testing a system that will prevent that from happening in the future. It's up 4 minutes before 8 o'clock here on KBOO. And again, joining the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. Let's talk about it seems like the idea of having sustainable food systems it's a nice dream, but we are so entrenched in this industrial model. And you're talking about this food system of the future now. And I'm remembering back when we were kids and we were the food system of the future. Then was going to be, everything was going to be in tubes. Everything was going to be created by chemicals. That was the great utopian dream. So it seems funny now our utopian dream of the future is back to the past.
Right. And for the past couple of years, I've been involved in an extremely interesting project in California. And it's called the Vivid Picture Project, and it was sponsored by a group of foundations, 9 foundations around the country, got together and said, you know what, we've been funding sustainable agriculture and sustainable food systems research and grants for 35 years. Where has it gotten us? Sustainability is such a great idea. Why isn't it pervasive? Why isn't it the dominant idea? And they pulled together a group of advisors, top-level political advisors, business advisors, theorists, academics, and they said, okay, what's our problem here? And what these advisors came back and said, and they were specifically talking about California, but they specifically said, the sustainable food systems movement is really good at identifying problems. We have this tremendous core competency. We can tell you what the hunger rate is in our states or our counties. We can tell you how many PCBs are in salmon. We can tell you what our problem with farm labor is, and poison incidents for farm workers, and the lack of housing for farm workers, and the fact that we're losing our farms, and we can organize a lot of campaigns around that. We as a movement have become very good at that. But we are very poor at developing a vision for the future, particularly as a group. And by the way, Walmart is really good at it. And if we could be that good, if we could develop a vision that was that strong and pervasive, perhaps we actually could make sustainability the dominant idea. So with a team of folks based at EcoTrust, which is a nonprofit based in Portland, Oregon, that works up and down the West Coast, we took a team of folks, researchers, to California and really explored the idea of what would a sustainable food and farming system for the entire state of California look like. So it's a massive undertaking. And the results are just now becoming public through the organization that founded it, which is the Roots of Change Council, based out of San Francisco. You can find them on the web. And the project involved many, many different facets. We looked at hundreds of different data sets, and we interviewed lots of different people. But one of the interesting things was how hard it was for people to talk about a vision of the future. They might be able to say, well, we're not going to be a petroleum-based economy. But kind of really getting beyond that, how do you talk about that? So what we did is we set a year in the future, and we picked the year 2030. Our friends in the organic industry suggested we use a 25-year timeline. They said, you know what, you can do a lot in 25 years. You can still see the future. You can still imagine you might be around in 25 years, and a lot can get done. So we picked this year, 2030, and we put a series of sustainability leaders into a process that we called backcasting. And we put them literally in their minds in the year 2030. And these were people that were heads of NGOs, nonprofit organizations, the heads of public agencies that deal with food or farming, farmers, fishers, ranchers, people that are chefs, restaurateurs, people that run markets. And we put them basically into a time capsule and said, okay, it's the year 2030. There's a sustainable food and farming system in the entire state of California. What does it look like? And through a series of exercises, we took them through. They began to imagine the future. And so what came out of that, and I can give you some of the details around it, but what came out of that is a report called The New Mainstream. And it begins to put sustainability, a sustainable food system, at the center of our economy versus on the fringes.
Just to interject here, you are listening to KBOO Portland, listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 in the Portland metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, 100.7 in the Mid-Willamette Valley. It's 1 minute after 8 o'clock here on Locus Focus. I'm talking this morning with Elaine Brady, and we're talking about sustainable food systems. And if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. Well, do you think it's a sustainable move that Walmart is now selling organic food?
It's an interesting question. It's a very interesting question. We went through this project and we said, at the end of the project, one of the things that emerged is that in this year 2030, there are going to be many, many different size organizations that are involved in our economy. We need to have a very, very diverse small and mid-sized group of businesses, farms, fishers, ranchers, distributors, marketers, restaurants, and we're going to have some large players. And it's possible that Walmart's one of the large players, but the key is really to diversify. The key is to have, in this vision of the sustainable food system that came out, is to have benefits accrue locally, whether you've got a large, a mid-size, or a small organization functioning in the food system. Really, they need to provide and prove that they can provide benefits locally, whether that's through their donations budget, whether that's how they take care of the environment, whether it's the number of jobs they provide. And it's possible that Walmart's going to be a player in that. One of the tricks that we get, the people that have been involved in the sustainability movement, sometimes I think that we think that we're organic people. Like, that's how we define ourselves, is, you know, we started the organic movement and we brought it to the masses, and Walmart can't have it. It's ours. They're not allowed to have it. And there is, or they're going to dilute it, which they might. there's a huge risk that they might dilute that standard, and they have yet to prove what they can do. On the other hand, if you look at what the true environmental objectives are in agriculture, we want to have clean water, we want to have clean soil, we don't want anybody to be poisoned, and we need to do that quickly because, by the way, we're destroying our world very quickly. How can we do that in the most efficient manner as possible? Well, if you can turn more acres into pesticide-free zones or insecticide-free zones, whether it's organic or some other standard, you are having a huge impact on the environment and on all of these local regions and economies. So at some level, Walmart going organic is a victory. And the people that are have been part of the movement from the beginning, theoretically, we could declare victory and move on. And we know that there's a lot more that's beyond organic, and in some ways organic is not even sustainable. And so,
actually, I'm going to go back a little bit. I did see a sign at the food stand at Limbo Market next to Trader Joe's in Southeast, and I went by a couple weeks ago. They had a Beyond Organic sign out there, which I thought was kind of interesting because Limbo is definitely local place. And has some organic and actually some non-organic. So I may need to go in there and ask them, are they part of the Beyond Organic movement or what that's about? But I want to kind of talk about what does that mean? And
what's Beyond Organic?
Yeah.
And that's a great term that's out there. The other one you hear is Organic Plus. So you'll say, okay, if we were, and I have to go back to this, are we organic people? And what I want to say to the folks or the listeners that are out there that have been part of the changes in the positive changes in the food system is that we really need to remember that we can't define ourselves as organic people. We need to realize that what our core competency is, what we really do well, is that we're innovators and we're on the leading edge. And we need to continue to move in an innovative fashion. There's a guy by the name of David Lively that runs a produce distribution house called Organically Grown Companies. And he and his organization have started a whole sustainability initiative internally. And he says to his staff and to the people that he's associated with is, the question he asks is, do we really want a single generation revolution? Is this really just one revolution? Did we really just start the organic movement and now we're all going to give up and go home? He says, no, we've got hundreds of other things to do here. We need to move on to changing our fuel system. We need to figure out what is beyond organic. And so some of the ideas that of what is beyond organic is to really embrace many other components of farming. So organic pretty much is an environmental standard. And it could be a more sustainable standard potentially if it had labor components in it. Are the farm workers, is there a socially just system that's producing this product? If it could measure the benefits that accrue to a community. In Europe, they call this multifunctional farming. That's one of the new terms you're going to hear, is multifunctional farming. Have you heard it?
I haven't heard it. I like that term.
And what it really talks about is having many, many facets contributing to health. And the other piece of Beyond Organic that's interesting is that we have, as a matter of fact, you have many, many small farmers that are moving away from organics who have been organic farmers for years and have defined their business that way, and they're moving away from it because their niche is eroding and the big guys are taking over organics. And so they are actually these incredible innovators, and they're saying, okay, we defined organic one way. Now we need to go beyond organic. We really need to define it as having inputs that come from our farm and stay on our farm versus bringing in all these chemical inputs. So we have a set of farmers who are now trying to say, okay, what we really meant when we said organic 30 years ago is this. We want inputs to come from the farm, stay on the farm. We want the humus in the soil to accumulate. We want to work with the natural cycles. We want to produce seasonal foods. And we want to do it in a socially just manner. So those are some of the things that are coming out. There's also organic has nothing to do with maintaining wildlife habitat, wilderness corridors. And so those types of things you're hearing might be part of a beyond organic conversation.
Also monoculture, because there's two things that I think Michael Pollan writes about this in Omnivore's Dilemma. And it's also something that's very apparent when you start to investigate where our food comes from. But those organic strawberries, the Driscoll strawberries that come from Watsonville, are grown in, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of acres of strawberries. And yes, it's all organic, but it's still a monoculture. And then some of that, I think actually Painted Hills beef, which I know a lot of places are no longer carrying because they resorted to feedlots. And in fact, I do know at New Seasons, I've checked this out, that free-range beef, that wonderful beef that's sold there. I'm not a meat eater, so I'm only speaking theoretically that it's wonderful. But it's been the last six weeks of its life, each one of those steers spends in a feedlot. It's an organic feedlot. They're not fed. They're fed vegetarian corn, but they're not fed animal byproducts, but it's still feedlot cattle. So there's people that are really wanting to take a higher standard and say, no, we need to have all of our beef be grass finished and our hogs be, I guess, whatever hogs eat, garbage and all kinds of slops, but not eat animal byproducts. And so that kind of takes it to another step.
Yeah, we are really going to see a change in the beef options as it relates to grass-fed. Grass-fed is coming on strong. It's a different taste than the beef that's finished on corn. I'm not a beef eater either, but I do understand that that's true.
Actually, the meat guy at the Selwood New Seasons Market was telling me, well, he thinks that it just doesn't taste as good if it's grass-finished. That was his opinion. I mean, hair might argue I haven't had, you know, a steak in years, but so I'm just like quoting Michael Pollan,
right,
which is not exactly the best way to argue a point. But I said, well, I understand that Argentina beef is considered the best beef in the world, and that's grass-finished. And he sort of had a nod, and so I guess I've heard that too. Now, I would not argue that New Seasons Market imports Argentina beef, because then that's kind of the opposite of what's trying to be sustainable.
Right. And I'm not a spokesperson for New Seasons Market, but the beef from New Seasons does come from this Oregon, this country natural beef that's, you know, based in Oregon from a, you know, set of cooperative ranches, which is just fantastic. One of the interesting things, and Michael Pollan does bring this up. Gosh, we should get Michael Pollan on the show.
Well, he was on a few weeks ago, actually.
Oh, he was. Oh, shoot. And he talks about how cows literally they're not made to digest grain. Again, here we are. We've subsidized all this corn. We're force-feeding the corn to all our animals, including our beef eaters. But they have, you know, they're ruminants, and so they process grass. But that finished product, a grass product, it's much leaner. It's kind of, some people say it's chewier, grass-fed beef. And so it's really an acquired taste. And obviously, long before corn subsidies, we all had more of an acquired taste that had to do with grass-fed beef. But now we've gotten into this kind of marbled, you know, grade A, grade B, grade C, finished grain beef.
And then the other side, of course, the most efficient food processor in the world is the salmon. And the idea of taking this fish that goes out as this tiny little critter, goes out into the ocean, eats whatever it eats in the ocean and turns into this 25, 50-pound critter that comes back up the river and does this all in a period of 3 to 5 years. Now, that's efficiency, as opposed to salmon farming, where you take the little critters and you feed them corn. And they feed them other, I guess also they kind of ransack the oceans for little bits of small fish that they feed them as well. But, and they feed them antibiotics and all kinds of other stuff. But the fish aren't allowed to roam, which is the same thing with cattle too, that these critters need to be able to move around and be free ranging in order to really efficiently put on weight in their body. And we can force it in a different kind of way, but it takes a lot more energy. Literally, it takes more petroleum and it takes a whole lot of other intensive energy to do the same thing that could be done much more efficiently with nature without any human intervention at all.
Right. And we are, you know, EcoTrust has done a huge amount of work on salmon, really building out the concept of Salmon Nation as a place that we live, and has released a lot of information about salmon. One of the interesting things about salmon is that they are trying, now these fish farms are trying to force feed these fish grain and vegetables, but they can't do it very well. and they haven't quite figured out how to do it. And so they have to feed these fish in the fish farm, little tiny fish, mackerel or whatever, and they are dredging the seas, and we're losing the bottom end of our food chain in order to feed our fish farms, which is really unfortunate. Yeah, and I think that you're absolutely right that we are facing a interesting crisis about how do you raise animals? You know, the humaneness of animals. I mean, we all should be free range, right? I want to be a free range person, and don't lock me in a room, and we should have free range chickens, and our salmon should be able to. It seems like so obvious, seems so much common sense, and I hope that the sustainable food system of the future has a lot more common sense in it.
Oh, we're talking with Elaine Brady, and she is does a lot of work on sustainable food systems and is the former vice president for the Food and Farms Program of EcoTrust. And if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. It's 14 minutes after 8 o'clock here on KBOO. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Morning. I saw the face of Antichrist last night on the television, and he was a yellow smiley face selling products and singing happy songs, okay? The face of Antichrist, smiling happy face. Walmart.
Okay, yes.
Walmart.
Yes.
I'd have to conclude that if Walmart is now selling organic food, I'd suspect that they're really trying to outcompete local merchants, and ultimately to benefit the large agribusinesses. They not only, you know, they in so many ways have no clue about sustainability, not just how the, you know, foods are produced and distributed, but also how land is used, you know, how they plop down a great big giant warehouse store wherever. That's a key indicator of what Walmart's all about, and I think you should, you know, look at it then that way. Look at Walmart that way, the Antichrist.
Okay.
Okay.
An appropriate observation on 6606, I guess.
Let's put down a great big parking lot with a great big store, and everybody will drive there, and they'll have to, you know. Yeah, it's, well, let's build our places so that we have no farmland left, and because we need to park our cars somewhere, right? That's what Walmart's about.
Paving paradise, huh?
Absolutely.
Well, right. One of the interesting things about Walmart is that they are, in order for them to pull off this organics thing, we don't see any way they can do it without importing, without going to second and third world countries and really developing organic agriculture out of this country. And when they do that, they will compromise flavor and taste because they have to.
Well, I saw a good Mupper sticker that said food 1,500 miles, and there was an arrow. Well, it was a sign. And then it said, better food 50 miles with an arrow. You
know? I saw that, too. Yeah. That was great. That was an ad in the Edible Portland. Edible Portland is just a tremendous new magazine in town. Definitely something to pay attention to.
I hope Edible Portland can export that idea and convince people that importing foods from as far away as we do is not sustainable, no matter whether they label it organic or not. Ultimately, the global economy requires too much fuel. Hey, well, great morning.
Okay, well, thanks for calling. Well, actually, I mean, I'm thinking not just Walmart, but Whole Foods imports organics from 1,500 miles or 2,000 miles away. And Michael Pollan writes in Omnivore's Dilemma about having some asparagus he buys in January that was imported from Chile or Argentina at Whole Foods for his Whole Foods meal that he describes in the book, and that it was kind of limp and tasteless and expensive.
You're going to compromise taste. And the thing, you know, organics promise is that it's going to taste better. And that is certainly not written into the regulations, but that's in our heart and our soul, and that's kind of what we thought. And so to have cardboard produce that's called organic coming from, you know, thousands and thousands of miles away is going to be tough. And I think the entire system, whether you're it's a large restaurant chain, it's McDonald's, or it's Walmart or Whole Foods or Safeway, if they really want to take up the challenge of providing flavor and supporting local economies, they're going to be pushed to try and figure out how to set up local systems. local growing systems, local distribution systems, and we're going to see big players as well as small players attempt to set those systems up. And I don't know, it's going to be an interesting thing to watch, actually. But one of the crises, that one of the things you lose with so much imported food is really this an urban-rural relationship. And you pave over paradise. We were talking about Connecticut the other day. You know, it's just the same population in Connecticut, essentially, as there is in Oregon. And it's a little over 3 million people. And think about the size of that state. Connecticut's tiny.
It's about the size of the Portland metropolitan area. No,
yeah.
But it's not a whole lot bigger. No, it's actually about, I think, like if you were to go from Astoria to Portland and then back to the coast, that's the size
about
of Connecticut.
It. Right. And if you've ever driven out there, you know how many cars and how much concrete is out there. There's some beautiful places. But they literally have lost their opportunity at this point to have a local food system in state that can support their population. And so we in Oregon still have an opportunity to maintain that. But what you lose is this urban-rural relationship. And in this Vivid Picture project that I worked on in California, we really took a hard look at the fact that mentally, when people think about their food system, we're living on the fumes of a myth of an urban-rural partnership that's about 100 years old, you know, where you really knew your farmer, you went to the market or the public market, and you saw the farmers all the time. And there's a myth that still exists in the United States about this urban-rural partnership, but it's not real. And there is a huge divide, and you can see it politically between the red and the blue counties. And you can see it happening when you start to import more and more of your foods. But we think that there's an opportunity. This project really said, you know what, there is an opportunity for a new urban-rural partnership, a social contract for the 21st century between new urban and rural players. And there's a set of issues that you can build a civic conversation around. And it's time to do that between urban and rural players. So whether it's land use, energy use, can the agriculture, rural or coastal communities produce energy that then could be used in the cities, whether you're talking about fuel or some kind of electric wind power, et cetera. All of the local buying compacts, can local urban markets begin to consciously support their rural counterparts? One of the things that's happening politically for the agriculture community across the United States is very interesting. They are losing their political clout as we lose population from the rural communities to the urban centers. All of a sudden you have, you know, in redistricting, et cetera, you end up with a population that's very urban focused and is very focused on urban rules and urban concerns. And the ag people don't like that, the small ag people and the large ag people. And so it's in the rural people's interests, really, at this point, to begin to build these new urban-rural partnership. And it's time for the urban people to really open up and go, okay, hold on. Let's look at that, our relationship with our farms, and what it is that they have to offer. So that's part of the vision, is that there's a new social contract for the 21st century that really rebuilds this urban-rural partnership.
Well, I was thinking a few years ago, I was doing some work in Marin County around land use issues, and a lot of the farmers there were complaining that the urbanites and the little urban strip of East Marin and also in Alameda and San Francisco counties wanted them to keep farming because they wanted to have a pretty landscape to drive through on the way to the beach. And so they said, well, we'll just put up cardboard cows. That's all. You don't care about what we're doing. You just care about, you know, having scenery. And so a bunch of environmental activists in Marin, including Barbara Boxer, actually, because this is where she got her start politically, was fighting suburbanization and suburban sprawl in West Marin County. They started working with the farmers. And so not only were they trying to get the farmers to agree to have land use laws that are probably about as stringent as the Oregon land use laws. It's the only part of California that's had this long history of a comprehensive land use plan. And so as the farmers would agree that they would not subdivide and they would support this whole way of having good land use laws, the part for the urbanites was to support the farmers in some of their concerns, like raising the price supports for milk. And so they would go to Sacramento with the farmers and lobby for higher price supports. And they would also work with the farmers when there are a whole bunch of issues about runoff and manure and water contamination. They would work with the farmers to help get funding from the state or from the county, as it came out, when they actually took over the county government, to pay the farmers to help subsidize their making improvements so that they weren't creating water runoff problems. So it was like a very pragmatic, practical relationship between the urbanites and the farmers, and that's something I'd really like to see in this state.
Well, a couple thoughts on that. One is that I don't know if you've ever been to spent any time in Europe talking to the food activists in Europe, but they have a bumper sticker. The urban food activists or environmental activists have a bumper sticker. It's called, it says, "Eat the Landscape." Eat the Landscape? Eat the Landscape.
I think something like that.
Eat the Landscape, View the Landscape, Eat the Landscape. And the idea is that if you want a landscape, if you actually want open space, you need to support that community, that rural community, by eating the landscape. And the interesting thing about farmers that the urban people forget is that the farmers are providing this incredible service of having open space for us to look at, for us to wander through, on drive through, etc. And they do it off the government payroll. So they do it by self-supporting. If we were sometimes on the progressive people have a tendency to say, we have a tendency to say, okay, let's put some government money into creating open spaces. And without looking at what is economically already generated for us, and then to value that and to say, okay, you know, thank you to the farmers that are stewarding this land, maintaining it as open space. Not only are they not getting subsidies from counties or cities or states to do that, but they're actually paying taxes if they're doing well. So that becomes a sustainable system. But we need to really see that and value that like they're doing in Marin County. Marin County is a fantastic place.
And it's one of the few places in the West that looks, that a lot of parts of Marin County don't look that different than they did in 1972 when I was stomping around there a lot.
Right, you just don't realize that the cows are cardboard now.
Well, I did see a few cardboard cows a few years ago when I was spending a lot of time there, but there's still a lot of really fine cows. And one of the best organic dairies in the country is up there just north of...
Are you thinking of Strauss?
Yeah. I guess there's another one now, too. I spent time
Clover Stornetta?
Yeah, I spent time at Strauss Farm a few years ago, uh-huh. And it was a pretty amazing operation.
Strauss Farm is a fantastic story because they were a conventional dairy, and it was a family farm, and four kids that eventually took over the farm, and they were going under. And in 1992, they took up this battle cry that we talked about earlier, decommodify or die. How can we sell and create a dairy product that has more value than just the price point? And they got very, very serious and converted over to organics. And they didn't know how to do it. And they were just learning by the seat of their pants, but they're very motivated. And they obviously have a creamery, or if you know their products, they have a creamery. They do yogurts and ice creams, et cetera, as well as milk. And if you go to their farm now, they are very serious. They are now further along than a lot of the organic people were about sustainability. And they have this huge methane digester that's producing a lot of the energy that is supporting the dairy. They're very much trying to have a self-sufficient on-farm, managing their inputs throughout their farm. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I was there, I think, in 99. Ellen Strauss is still alive then. She was an amazing woman. But it's very exciting that the children are caring. I mean, the children are...
They're older children, yeah.
40s and 50s now. But that next generation. And I also got the feeling that it's going to be a multi-generational farm. They were just beginning to kind of diversify in their outreach and sustainability when I was there. But it was a pretty impressive operation back then.
Well, again, when you think about what is the indicator, what would the indicator be for a successful, sustainable food and farming system? How would we know we're there? You know, if there's any callers out there, I'd love to hear some feedback. How would you know that we had a sustainable food and farming system? What would be the indicator that you would hold on to? And the one of the ones that people talk about is, what's the average age of a farmer? And can you see the children growing up to take over the farm? And, of course, the average age of a farmer in along the entire West Coast is right around 55. And I think in Oregon, it's 49% of the farmer operators are over 55. So where are our farms? You know, who's going to be running our farms in 15, 20 years is a very important, interesting, current, urgent question. The farms in So if you look at what the indicator is, it has to do with how many children do you see growing up to take over the farms. And we have just recently, I just talked to the Hatfields, again, back to this Country Natural beef example, and they have decommodified their product, that the product has values beyond price. It has a lot of quality-oriented values about the environment and taking care of people and health and nutrition. And they now have, and as part of their co-op, they have, she just told me, they have 25 kids under 5. So they have a lot of young families that are now a part of this co-op, which is very unusual. It's a completely different trend than you see in the conventional agriculture system. And you're going to see that. So Strauss Farm is a great example of a place where the kids took over and the kids are raising kids that are interested in the business.
And getting back to strawberries, when I was talking to the young woman at the Unger Farm stand in Tigard on Sunday, I asked her if she was going to go into the family farm business, and she shook her head like, I'm getting out of here when I graduate, but my brother is. And that was, so I'm glad to know that Unger Strawberries has another generation coming up for that.
Well, it's very interesting to kind of think about what's going to draw these kids into food and farming. And one of the things actually we heard at the conference the other day as well is that there is a certain amount of technology that is exciting for the kids. And there's a certain amount of sophistication. The organic or sustainable growers or the certified growers are some of the most sophisticated growers out there, people out there, the professions. It's a very different profession than it was 100 years ago. And so the kids, the interest in GIS systems or the computer systems that are tracking and monitoring the system are definitely a draw for these kids. You know, even on the most sustainable of farms, there is a sophistication of how do these ecological systems interact with each other, what technologies are needed, and it's become a profession you really need to be trained for, which then becomes more interesting to the younger generation. Sometimes I think that one of the things that came out of this Vivid Picture project is that we as a sustainability community need to embrace technology. We need to bring it with us. That sometimes people think the mass public or think about sustainability as being a throwback to kind of cart and oxen days. But in fact, it's some of the more innovative work that's been done in a century has to do with all the work that's been poured into sustainability systems and understanding them and building them. And innovation really needs to be a cornerstone of what we're known for. So not only on farm, but we often give the example of in this year 2030, remember we're talking about envisioning a sustainable food and farming system for the entire state of California for the year 2030, and we have a picture in our slideshow, actually, of a little mom, a mom with a little kid in her lap in her kitchen, and she's saying, yeah, we know our farmers. We can see them on the webcam, which is on our refrigerator. We can see our strawberries getting picked this morning. And if we are truly believe in transparency, which the sustainability community values, then we need to embrace the technologies that help us bring that transparency to our food system. And it keeps it exciting and interesting and part of the next generation.
And I mentioned that Eileen is the first guest I've ever had who's here in the studio with her laptop computer and her BlackBerry. So she's keeping up on technology.
Absolutely. It's fun, you know. I love my iPod and my BlackBerry and all that stuff.
But anyway, it's about 28 minutes before 9 o'clock here on KBOO. You're listening to Locus Focus. And I'm here with Eileen Brady, who is a sustainable food systems consultant and somebody, more than a consultant, I think she's a... probably a zealot, actually, if I could think of the right word, but definitely impassioned on this subject. And we started out talking about strawberries. There's three strawberries left here in this little basket.
You can
and
have one, Barbara,
I will have
but
one.
I don't think they're so sweet yet. I think next week's going to be better.
Yeah. Well, I'll be over at your garden next week then.
Okay.
And if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air. Let's see what happened to her. I know we had a few callers queued up. I hope they haven't given up on us since we've been talking for so long.
I didn't know.
Hello, you're on the air. Well, still no caller. We'll try one more
call
time.
Call back.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine.
Okay, great. Thank you for the conversation this morning. I want to point out that there is, in the May-June issue of Mother Jones, it's the series of articles is called "The Revolution Will Not Be Shrink-Wrapped," and it's a breakthrough in the industrial food chain. It's by Michael Pollan, and it's a very, very good read, and it's worth picking up and looking at.
Well, great. Thanks for that tip.
Okay.
Keep Michael Pollan alive on this show.
Okay. And like number two, you were talking about sustainability. My wife and I are localists. We only care about shopping in businesses that are owned by Oregonians who support other Oregonians. And we vote with our dollars, and we prefer to keep our money in the loop because it's very, very important for us to build a sustainable economy here in Oregon. It's our obligation for living in this state.
Okay.
We call you a citizen consumer.
Well, yeah, that's what we are. We wouldn't care if Walmart gave away their organic food for free. We wouldn't take it because we do not care about their business model. The reason that we shop at like New Seasons is because we love your business model. It's absolutely a pleasure to shop there. The employees there are like dedicated to serving the members of the community, and we really appreciate it. And being we're seniors, we shop there every Wednesday. Thank you very much for your 10% off.
Okay, well, thanks for calling.
And Thank you for calling.
I've noticed that 10% off is becoming quite a widespread fashion in I think all around Oregon. But I was noticing someplace else that's not even a food store that's giving 10% off on Wednesdays, and I thought, that sounds really good. Another thing, there's a program I'm not sure if it's all seniors or just low-income seniors, but they're sending out packets this week with $26 worth of coupons to spend at farmers markets and food stands. And it's a program that's sponsored by the Department of Human Services in the state. And it might be connected with the Oregon Health Plan, but it's not just people on food stamps. I think it's for a higher range of people. But if you're over 60, you may be getting a package of coupons to shop at your farmer's market. And I was very excited when I found about this program because I think it's one more way to encourage people to connect with their farmers. And more people are shopping at farmer's markets. And, in fact, I'm really excited because the Selwood Farmer's Market opened 2 weeks ago. And it's great. As much as I like going to other farmer's markets, there's nothing like walking five blocks. We actually went out and bought two big baskets because we've been carrying things back in these strange bags. So we have our baskets, and we can walk up to the farmer's market every Wednesday now and go shopping there. And not only get produce and all kinds of stuff, but also get starts and plants, which is a very exciting thing to buy locally.
I love the farmers market. And the Portland Farmers Market actually is hailed across the country as being one of the key examples of a flourishing farmers market. We're very lucky to have that system of farmers markets here. And I have actually we now have, I think we have close to 70 farmers markets in Oregon.
Actually, more than 70. There were 70 last year. Because I'm working on this documentary right now about this. And Suzanne Briggs told me last year it was 70.
Yeah.
So with the Selwood one, it might be 71.
Oh, so maybe we're up one.
Yeah.
Here's hoping. Rah-rah for the farmers markets because they create a quality of life that's, as fun as walking to the market and getting all those wonderful things. But it was not true 25 years ago. There were not farmers markets in any kind of numbers. There was, you know, under 10 farmers markets.
In fact, public markets were closing 25 years ago.
Exactly.
Like the old public market that's now the Yamhill Market here.
There you go. We're in a time of flourishing farmers markets across the country and flourishing local food systems across the country. And I've often thought that here's my dream, here's my fantasy for politics, actually, is that, you know how you have those in the general elections, there's the NASCAR dads and there's the soccer moms, that they talk about them as voting blocks. I actually think that one of the next voting blocks that we're going to see is the farmers market voter. Which means that those are the people that actually, whether they're from rural communities or urban communities, they understand the interface. They're not blue or red voters. They're more purple voters. And they will take up the challenge of really building out this new civic social contract, urban-rural partnership, and take on the issues in both parts of the constituencies. So I think we should look for the farmers market voting constituency.
Well, actually, I was at the Target Farmers Market on Sunday, and I went out there. I'm doing this documentary about farmers markets and gardens and things that we're talking about today. And there's this band that I know who play Andean and other Latin American folkloric music, and I knew they were playing out at the market, and I wanted to do some recording at the market, and I thought having their music in the background would sound really great. And they were at the Sandy Market on Saturday, but we missed that, and I thought, Sandy, I want to go out to Sandy. But so I decided, okay, I'm going to go to Tigert. So I overcame all my suburbia phobia and,
Highway,
you know,
99.
Figured out how to get there, and I knew it was at Washington Square too, which meant nothing to me. So I drove around actually for about 20 minutes trying to figure out where this farmer's market was, and I finally find the parking lot, and there it is. And so this big mall parking lot has been transformed. I felt like I was at our little parking lot in Selwood or down at the Park Blocks. It just felt like this was a farmer's market. But one interesting thing is, as I get out of my car, I look and there's a car right across the way from me, and it has a Bush Cheney bumper sticker on it. And I thought, well, I guess lots of people are going to farmer's markets. And I sort of kept that in my mind, and like an hour and a half later when I was going back to my car, and I look at my bumper stickers, impeach Bush and Cheney. I thought, I wonder if that guy who, you know, got into his car and had the Bush Cheney bumper sticker as he was bringing all his produce and loading his car, turned over his shoulder and looked at my car and thought, well, I guess all kinds of people go to the farmer's market. But it is an interesting intersection where people, I think that kind of political divide isn't as important as when we start to come together about where our food comes from.
Well, one of the things we've discovered in our qualitative research is that food and economics level the playing field. And they create more of a set of shared values across this so-called political divide, this urban-rural divide. And I think food and economics is kind of an interesting platform to build from. I have to say that on the farmer's market, you know, in the middle of the mall, which I think is just a brilliant icon and a hopeful icon for a food system, if you look at what Kaiser Permanente is doing, we have some very interesting members of the sustainable foods movement now. And healthcare, to a large degree, has gotten into that. And Kaiser is now sponsoring farmers markets in their parking lots. You can see this in California and a little bit up here now, that they are very focused on changing their cafeteria system so that, you know, lo and behold, finally when you're a patient in there, you can actually eat healthy foods. And
fresh food.
Fresh food. What do you know?
Fresh food in a hospital.
Isn't that brilliant? It's just brilliant that we finally come to that. But I got to hand it to them. They have a Thrive campaign that is very much leading edge. They're breaking new ground in the healthcare industry, and they're saying, you know, we can still make money and talk about health and nutrition and support farmers markets and things like that. The food system, really the sustainable movement, really started out in sustainable agriculture. And in the past 5, 6, 7 years, it's really morphed into a movement of sustainable food systems. So from sustainable ag to sustainable food. And when you do that, when you morph a movement, you end up with all sorts of new players. So you have all of a sudden you've got nutritionists that are in the sustainable food conversation. And you have, you know, the medical professionals, the doctors and the nurses. And it's very exciting. And as a matter of fact, the next farm bill is, as these farm bills go on and on, you're going to see more and more urban constituents coming to the tables. And these old conventional ag people are shocked. They're like, what are you doing? What are you doing at the table? You're a nutritionist. We're talking about agriculture here. And the conversation is, no, actually, we're talking about food here, and we're talking about the health of our children. And we want to transition some of those funds to supporting the health of our food system, not just the subsidized commodity products. So.
Well, I'm talking with Eileen Brady, and we're talking about sustainable food, and you can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. This is Locus Focus here on Kibu Community Radio. Hello, you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air. A little slow on the uptake. Okay, yeah, and I've just been reminded to tell you that if you are waiting on the phone, listen to your phone, not to the radio, because we have a 7-second delay now, and the radio is way behind what's actually happening here in real life at KBOO. So hopefully we have our caller. So hello, you're on the air? Nope, we still don't have that caller. Let's try another one. Hello, you're on the air. Speaking of new technology, we're still not quite there yet with our new technology. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. I got somebody. Hey, I got a quick question. I know you're talking organics. In the idea that the gentleman farmer is still out there and doing the backyard growing, can you guarantee that the ground is actually chemical-free? I've been seeing in the news that you got these meth houses where they dump everything in the backyard. Somebody else moves in. They decide they're going to do organic growing, and they don't know what's in the backyard, you know? That also applies to the bigger farms, too, I guess. But how do you verify that the ground that it's growing in is chemically free?
I'm not sure there's guarantees in life at all. And 100% guarantee, I don't know if you can guarantee it. I do think that they do go out and audit these organic farms. But we're seeing more and more issues that are related to non-point source pollution. So you can't really identify where a pollutant is coming from. So let's just think about air. You know, if air, there was some pollutant in the air and it blew into a field, is that field still organic? So same thing with water. Water is running down through streams. And if you're irrigating on your farm using any kind of stream water, you run the risk of all sorts of non-point source pollution. And hopefully, you know, through our, you know, water quality monitoring systems and soil quality watering systems, we're able to catch a lot of that. But the idea of meth houses dumping their stuff in on the ag farm, that doesn't sound too good.
No, it doesn't.
Well, actually, I mean, I think
that's frightening.
You can get your soil tested.
For sure.
And actually, as you're talking, I'm thinking about things like underground oil tanks, which probably aren't a great thing, and a lot of us have those in our yards, too. So I'm thinking maybe I'm going to get my soil tested this year. I am curious. I think
some of the older neighborhoods might still have the oil tanks, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of them do. And even though they're supposed to be taken out and all this stuff, it's like, so first of all, you find out if you have a tank, and secondly, find out if it's been sealed, and third, test your soil. So I think there's one thing you can do is you can test your soil personally, and you can find out how safe the soil that you're growing. The other thing is a concern if you've had your house painted and they've sanded your house and all the paint, and it's lead-based paint, and all the paint dust goes into the yard. And I'm just sitting here thinking about all the nightmares I've probably, you know, inflicted upon myself in the last 15 years where I am.
So if I've got bad soil, can I sell my stuff to Walmart?
Yeah. Why don't you sell your soil to Walmart, actually?
Just relabel it and put it on the shelf.
Then you get a yellow smiley face.
Right.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for calling. And we got some more callers here. I'm talking with Eileen Brady today. We're talking about sustainable food systems. And we got about another 14 minutes left to the show. You can call at 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for bringing this up about, you know, just not only just organic farming, but, you know, just sustainable practices in general. I think it's awesome that you guys are talking about this. And I'm sorry, I've been in and out listening to this show, so I didn't catch the name of the woman who's your guest today.
Her name is Eileen Brady.
Well, I heard that you're a co-owner of New Seasons Markets, and I heard, you know, your comment about how, you know, you're not actually a spokesperson for them, but at the same time, you know, since you are a co-owner, you know, that definitely implies that you have, to some extent, some extent of control over their practices, and to some extent you do endorse them as a company. So I think that it's great that a person in your position is actually, you know, bringing discussions like this to the table.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said thank you. Yeah.
Now the caveat
continue,
comes.
Yeah.
Yeah. However.
Yeah, however, I think it's ironic, you know, when we're having a discussion about sustainable agriculture and just sustainable food supplies in general, that we're still leaving the subject of meat farming up as though it is, you know, in some way, as though there is a way to make that a viable food source, when, in my opinion, it's not. You know, especially when we're talking about, and you briefly mentioned this earlier in the show, we're talking about a very real possibility of there being a limited water supply in the future. It takes tons more water to raise cattle and other animals and other livestock than it does to raise or grow an equivalent nutritional amount of plant matter. So that right there, you know, makes animal farming just completely unsustainable or unviable when you compare it to vegetarian agriculture.
Actually, I want to interject for a second. I think that it's very much true. If you, the way conventional animals are raised, especially corn-fed animals, that both in the amount of petrochemicals that go into feeding that animal and the water, it's immense. But if you were to have completely free-range animals, and I don't actually know, I think there are a few totally free-range sources of beef in this country, and I'm not sure, but I know that they're very few and far between. But if you were to do completely free-range beef, and it was all grass-fed, I don't think it would be nearly as water-intensive as the way that we raise beef right now.
Well, I'll tell you something. It does use a lot of water, and the caller is absolutely right. You know, raising anything high on the food chain requires a lot of inputs, and one of them is water. And I have to tell you, this is how much of a food and farming geek I am. The book that I carry with me, I just pulled out, is the Yearbook of the Department of Agriculture from 1910. It's their report. It's just an old, funky book. And I always have to remind myself of how these issues have been going on for years and years. There's actually a whole section in this 1910 report on the duty of water. That's what they called it. What's the duty of water? And they postulate that in order to raise beef, and that's at the standards, the 1910 standards, before all of the grain infusion, that we were going to run out of water to raise the beef we need for our population. So this is an issue that not only you feel and know in your heart, but they were talking about 100 years ago. And we as a community have not resolved it. And we continue to learn and grow, and we have to hope that, you know, the next generation is smarter than this one.
Well, I mean, there's probably a lot of good reasons to be a vegetarian. I mean, I mean, it's something that I don't feel like I want to impose on listeners. I mean, I'm not a vegetarian, actually. I don't eat any mammals, but I do eat fish and fowl, and so some people would have problems with that. But I've sort of leveled off to where I feel comfortable. I, however, do not feel like I can impose my food values on people who do choose to eat meat. And it's very interesting talking with Michael Pollan. And we had this conversation with Michael Pollan a few weeks ago, who is a meat eater and has gone to the extremes of studying, you know, how the meat comes to his table. And I just heard him speak a couple weeks ago again here, and I think he's having some real second and third thoughts about eating meat, because the more he learns about it, the harder it is to literally stomach. So you might want to talk to Michael Pollan and see what he thinks about this too.
I think I might do that, but you know, at the same time, you talk about you don't want to oppose, you know, that kind of you know, lifestyle decision on your listeners, and I can respect that. But at the same time, you know, I'm not even just talking about imposing it upon people as much as I'm talking about, you know, on the one hand, you're having this discussion about sustainable agriculture and sustainable food supplies, and you're talking about it, you know, as though it's the thing to do. And I think that it's equally important to talk about vegetarianism as just simply the smart and, you know, environmentally sound alternative to what we've been doing in the past. And I think it's a bit of contradiction to, on the one hand, endorse the sustainable organic movement and beyond organic and that sort of thing without, you know, broaching the subject of vegetarianism.
Well, I have to say that I'm a vegetarian also, and for lots of those reasons. And there is, in this futuring work that we've done with a lot of the leaders in California on the sustainable food and farming system, one of the visions that these people have is that there is less meat consumed. For some people say that's for nutritional reasons, some people say it's for environmental reasons, but that in general, we as humans, whether you're an environmentalist or just a nutritionist, need to ingest more fresh vegetables, grains, just whole foods that are grown lower on the food chain. So I appreciate your passion for that, because you know you've got part of the keys to the kingdom, and we all have to use our knowledge to further this movement. So thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
And we got time for at least one more caller. So hello, you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to thank you all for a great show. It's really timely. I myself am in organic. I'm an importer of organic commodities, and all of what's going on now with Walmart and, you know, Michael Pollan's new book and his pieces in the New York Times, it's just really timely.
Can I just interject for a second? What kind of organic commodities do you import?
I work with manufacturers. So I import, beans and seeds and mm-hmm. whatnot, whatever they're putting into the cold cereals and bars and, you know, canned soups and whatnot that appear in all of our local markets.
Great.
But being on the other end of the sustainability model and argument, and not really on the other end of the argument, but on the model, and also myself living in Southeast Portland and shopping at all the, you know, local farmers markets and whatnot, the question of the moment for me and the question of the moment the question I would like to pose to Eileen is, when we're talking about farmers markets, when we're talking about producing sustainably, even though we're shopping at the farmers markets, even though we're shopping at New Seasons, we are still working within a model that splits production and where we live. So even if you're buying locally and you buy from within 150 miles, let's say, we're still not buying, or we're still not growing food in the community that we're really living in, which is right here in the city. And so what can be done on a local level? What can be done by local businesses like New Seasons? What can be done by members of the community to help reintegrate food production? I mean, truly reintegrate it, mm-hmm. not into a local as opposed to global economy, but into a truly local economy, mm-hmm. and not even as a local economy, but into a local community.
Yeah. You know, this is an issue that many local food systems are struggling with across the country. And they're saying, if we really want to have a local food system, we need to have it be in our backyard. We need to be able to walk down the street and get our eggs from the chicken coop. And, you know, Portland is involved in a project called the Diggable City. And the Dan Saltzman's office has put together a survey, it's absolutely fascinating, of all of the public lands, their city lands, that might be available for growing food. And it might be, you know, just vacant land. It might be some school properties. It might be, I think, around, like, electrical units. You have to have a buffer zone of land. And so they have come up with quite a few places in the city. And Portland is playing with the idea of really digging up the city and getting our hands in the dirt. And I encourage you to get behind that. There's a group at Portland State that is helping put that together. And I know Dan Saltzman's office could get you in touch with that, but it could be, I think, you know, the future is bright. And just imagine all of these gardens around Portland on our, you know, parking strips and, you know, in our neighborhoods. And it could be very interesting and very rich.
I was just actually reading an article last night And it quoted Leslie Pohl Kosbaugh, who started the Portland Community Gardens. And she said that we need to think of our entire city as a garden. Rather than just gardening in the city, the city is the garden. And that if we treated the city as we treat our private backyard plots, what an incredible place this would be. So I think that in many ways, we are living in a garden city, and we can take the most advantage of it. We are just about running out of time, so I want to thank Eileen Brady for joining us today, and listeners for calling in with some very good questions. And this is a topic we will continue to talk about. And sort of all on the same subject, Michael Pollan's speech at the Illahi Lecture Series, I think it was May 11th, is going to be broadcast here on KBOO June 23rd at 9 a.m. And then the documentary that I'm doing, which is still doesn't have a title yet, but it's about the intersection of nature and the city, and we'll be looking at the importance of preserving natural spaces in the city, going to farmers markets, and growing our own gardens, particularly community gardens, and that's going to air on Monday, July 31st at 9 o'clock. So we'll be continuing this conversation, and I hope to get Eileen back again in the near or distant future whenever and continue this conversation, because it's a really important thing to be talking about because we are what we eat. So coming up on KBOO this morning at 9 o'clock, the bike show, we're hearing about Pedalpalooza, a two-week festival of bike events. At 10 o'clock on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller investigates the concept of state secrets privilege and George W. Bush's use of privilege. At 10:30 here, reporter Aaron Glantz, author of How America Lost Iraq and co-author of recent articles Multiply, Haditha by Thousands, and Basra Explodes. At 11 o'clock on Democracy Now, he interviews with Bureau Chief for Knight Ritter on the killing of an unarmed Iraqi man in Himadiya by a group of Marines. Journalist Eric Borlett discusses his new book, Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, and Thomas Friedman on petropolitics and more. That's all coming up. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio. And this is Barbara Bernstein, Locus Focus. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the rest of the day. First degree. He's as sweet as Tupelo honey, just like the honey from the you can't stop us on the road to freedom. You can't stop us, 'cause our eyes can see men with insight, men in granite, nights and
it's 9:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Welcome to the Wednesday morning radio zine. Coming right up is the KBOO Bike Show. We'll hear about Pedalpalooza, a two-week festival of bike events. And at 10, Andrew Geller will be here for People Rise Up. He will be speaking with William Weaver, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas, El Paso, an expert on privilege, on the concept of state secrets privilege. And also he'll talk to Michael Avery, law professor at Suffolk University, who is assisting the Center for Constitutional Rights in battling Bush's use of the privilege. At 10:30, Marianne Barasanik interviews reporter Aaron Glantz, author of How America Lost Iraq, and co-author of the recent articles Multiply Haditha by Thousands and Basra Explodes. And at 11, stay tuned for Democracy Now!